It's Jobs Day Friday, so we've got that going for us. Some internet security news you can use as well. And to wrap it all up, an interview with director Barry Jenkins about his new film. It's called Moonlight. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Friday, the 4th of November. Good to have you along, everybody. Today being the third Friday after the conclusion of the reference week, which is, should you be curious, the week that includes the 12th of the month. Yes, that was geeky. We learned this morning that 161,000 people got jobs in this economy last month and that the unemployment rate notched down to 4.9%. It is also, if it has somehow escaped your notice, the last Friday before Election Day, so we are going to spend the next 4 minutes or so talking about the intersection of those two things. We're going to do it with Neela Richardson. She's at Redfin. John Carney is at the Wall Street Journal, and they are both in our studios in New York City. Hey, everybody.
Hi, Kai.
Hi, Kai.
All right, Neela, let's start with you and this jobs report. 4.9%, 161,000 new jobs, as we said. We've got a package on wages coming up afterward, and I know that's your big thing. But the good news on wages takes us to a place where maybe this growth can keep going, yeah?
Yes, we finally got the Goldilocks level of employment, right? It's not too hot, it's not too cold, it's perfectly proportioned in all the right places, which is that big pop in wage growth. And so the great news is it's good showing some momentum going into the fourth quarter. It also means that it's an average enough jobs report that it's great political fodder. You can spin it any direction you want. It's not strong enough. It's too strong.
Right.
So it feeds into the election cycle. But overall, it's showing a fairly healthy economy ending 2016.
And spun it has indeed been, John. But I am obliged to note that the S&P 500 closed today, even with its jobs report, ending its longest losing streak in 36 years, 9 down days on the S&P. That has to be election agita, right?
Sure. There's a lot of election agita. But I will say it is 9 down days, but it is the shallowest days in history. We're down like 3% over those days.
Yeah.
The last time we were down for 9 days in a row, I think we were down 20%. So it is there is a little agita. I do think that if it wasn't just spun by politicians, by the way, today's jobs number. There were Wall Street analysts on both sides of the question of what does this mean for a Fed rate hike in December? Some people said, well, it doesn't necessarily give them the green light. And Fannie Mae's chief economist said it's a done deal. It's definitely going to happen in December. Conflicting reports on both sides.
We're going to pass on the inner workings of the mind of Janet Yellen for now, Neela. And let's play it forward to what happens on Wednesday morning, assuming this thing is wrapped up Tuesday night. Whoever gets this job come Tuesday has a bunch of work ahead of him or herself to take this economy to a place where maybe everybody's feeling the benefits, right?
That's right, because what's missing, what's obscured in the jobs report is the shift from manufacturing to service jobs, lower paying service jobs. And that feeds into the crux of the angst that's been tapped by this electorate, the sense that the middle class is not sharing the prosperity that's being built by corporate America is real. And whoever the next president is, they'll have to address that angst and provide a plan for moving past it.
John, let me ask you basically the same question. But what happens once you throw Congress in the mix with a president who will have deep divisions behind him or her?
There will definitely be a lot of deep divisions. I think if we have a Republican House of Representatives, possibly a Republican Senate, and a Democrat in the White House, that we will just get a lot more sort of stalemate. I don't think you'll get very much accomplished policy-wise, which will not be good for the economy.
Well, explain that a little bit, because my next question was going to be, what do we need to get accomplished economy-wise?
I think that one thing that would be good would be something like a sensible infrastructure expansion plan. That's possible if you got – maybe if the Democratic if the Senate goes Democratic and you have a Democratic president, or if you get a Republican president and two Republican houses. Mm-hmm. But if we get divided government again, I think it will be very hard for them to work out any kind of deal, because none of them will think that it's in their interest, either in the Congress or the White House, to compromise with each other.
And we need a government that gets out of the way of private America. If they can't compromise, if they can't come to agreement, if we do have a divided government, we need a government that at least stays on the sideline and doesn't become a spectacle and a sideshow in things like raising the debt ceiling,
for example, creating
a budget for the economy. We at least need the private sector to be able to work unimpeded by uncertainty. Sorry, Kai.
You're going to throw debt limit on top of this election? That's Neela Richardson from Redfin and John Carney from the Wall Street Journal. Thanks, you two.
Thank you, Kai.
Have a good weekend.
You too. Wall Street, we talked about, as John said, it was not down a whole lot, but down it was. We will have the details when we do the numbers. All right, so a tad more about that jobs report now. Wages, as I was talking about with Neela, specifically, and this fact from the report this morning, they are growing at their fastest rate since the recovery started seven, what feels like really, really long years ago. That's a good thing. Well, it's an okay thing anyway. From Washington, Marketplace's Scott Tong explains what's going on there.
Wages grew 2.8% the past year. Really? When economists say real, they mean adjusted for inflation, which is ticking up. Lakshman Achithan is co-founder of the Economic Cycle Research Institute.
Wage gain is great. We're not going to quibble with that. And it's the best we've seen since 2009 when the recession ended. Half of those increases, you're not really going to feel because you're just paying it out in rent and healthcare.
The pay gains now are nothing like those pre-recession. Ordinarily, when the jobless rate is low, as it is now, bosses pay more to lure scarce workers. Not this time, says economist Brad Hirschbein at the Upjohn Institute for Employment Research. He says lots of people quit looking for jobs in the downturn, and they're just now coming back.
As long as they continue to do that and they flow back in, then employers can hire people without raising wages that rapidly. And only when it gets really tight are you going to start to see much more rapid wage growth of the kind that we saw, say, in the late 90s.
Another thing workers are waiting for, productivity gains. Innovation and automation help workers make more, so they make more. But for now, productivity is tepid and kind of ignored, says Kathy Boschancic at Oxford Economics.
I guess the one thing I would say, because we are in the heat of the election season, none of the candidates have really adequately addressed pro-productivity, pro-growth measures. Most economists think that's the most critical issue right now.
Particularly when it comes to paychecks. Really. I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
The candidates and their surrogates have been making their stretch runs this week, and Florida has been getting a whole lot of love, each side trying to hit just the right mix of messages to galvanize their voters and get them to the polls. One thing that stirs those voters up pretty good is the minimum wage. Four states, Washington, Colorado, Arizona, and Maine, should you be curious. Four states have minimum wage increases on the ballot. In Florida, a wage hike proposal didn't quite make it to the ballot, but Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman reports it's still a potent issue for voters across party lines.
Hillary Clinton appeared at a city park in Tampa last week, and on a warm day in front of a very warm crowd, she gave her Seal the Deal stump speech, including this guaranteed applause line.
We need to raise the national minimum wage so that people who work full time aren't left in poverty.
And afterward in the crowd, I met Bob Busing, a Tampa Democrat running for an open seat in the state Senate. He said the state's minimum wage currently stands at $8.05 an hour.
Well, let's do this in steps. Let's do 10, then go to 12, and then eventually 15.
And, Busing pointed out, even Donald Trump has called at some points in his campaign for a minimum wage hike. Here he was in Doral, Florida, back in July.
The minimum wage has to go up. People aren't... at least $10, but it has to go up. But I think that states, federal, I think that states should really call the shot.
So what's come out of Florida's state legislature lately? A lot of silence. Democrats have tried and been repeatedly blocked from even getting a minimum wage hike considered. Randy Pestana is a policy analyst at Florida International University.
It's very difficult to move a $15 an hour minimum wage proposal in a state that the House is dominated by Republicans, the Senate is dominated by Republicans.
Although some cracks have emerged recently, two South Florida Republicans running in new districts with a lot of Black and Latino voters came out last month in favor of hiking the state minimum wage. Pestana says Republicans increasingly need those voters to win. A 60-car caravana weaves its way through a Puerto Rican neighborhood in Orlando. It's part of a big Get Out the Vote drive led by the group Que Vote Mi Gente. Residents come out on their lawns to wave and cheer, among them Elizabeth Bermudez.
Votar para la gente is we have to vote for our community, para la gente de nosotros.
Bermudez supports her disabled father and 18-year-old daughter working as a medical bill coder. Until recently, she made minimum wage. She's for Hillary Clinton, and what does she want?
Help the minimum wage. We all are surviving. We all are sacrificing. We take care of our children, our husband, our home, our job. Yes!
Still, a big hike in the minimum wage is a non-starter for fiscally conservative Republicans, like Anthony Liga, a financial planner in Sarasota.
I think you can have a certain amount of a level of a minimum wage. But like I tell people who fight for the $15 minimum wage, why do we stop at 15? Let's go 50. Let's go 100. And then they'll come back and they'll say, well, that will destroy business. Yes, and so will 15.
But this issue also cuts deeply across party lines. Steve Fixon is 59, a contractor and handyman in Sarasota. He's Republican, an absolute partisan for Donald Trump.
I believe the minimum wage needs to come up. The cost of living has done nothing but go up.
Does 15 sound too high to you?
No, I don't believe so. I'd like to see some of the American people go out there and try to make a living and put a roof over their head and raise a family at $15 an hour. It's literally impossible.
A recent University of South Florida Nielsen poll found 51% of residents think a minimum wage hike to $15 an hour would take Florida's economy in the right direction. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
Coming up.
It doesn't fit the metrics of what's a studio film or what's a commercial film.
Director Barry Jenkins about his new film, Moonlight. But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrials off 42 points on this Friday, 0.2%, 17,888. The NASDAQ shed 12 points, 0.25%, 5,046. The S&P 500 extended its losing streak, as I mentioned, down 3 points, 0.1%. Closed at 2,085. For the week gone by, the Dow off 1.5%, the NASDAQ down 2.7%, S&P 500 1.9% lower. Starbucks said the campaign is holding down U.S. sales. Nonetheless, coffee retailer beat expectations in both sales and profits last quarter. And yes, by the by, those red cups are going to be back for the holidays. Starbucks shares up 1.9%. It's the weekend, 4 days before this. Oh, my goodness, election, and maybe we could do something stronger than coffee. Anheuser-Busch shares rose 0.1% today. Brown-Forman, which makes Jack Daniels, up 0.1%. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Ryssdal. I've got some good news, and I've got some bad news, y'all. Which one do you want first? All right, bad first. I'll decide. New Year's Eve has been sold. The good news is they went for $1 billion. All right, I exaggerate, but only a little bit. The Chinese conglomerate Dalian Wanda has bought Dick Clark Productions, home of the heretofore referenced New Year's Rockin' Eve, and a whole mess of other high-profile productions, the Golden Globes and Miss America among them. Marketplace's Rima Kreis has more on this latest Wanda purchase.
Wanda is having an awesome year, says Paul Duragarabedian, a media analyst with Comscore.
To seal their second billion-dollar deal in 2016, that's no small thing.
Earlier this year, it purchased Legendary Entertainment, producer of blockbuster movies like Jurassic World and Warcraft. And a few years ago, it bought the big theater chain AMC. Now, with its latest trophy, Dick Clark Productions, the Chinese entertainment group is delving into the TV world, says Duragarabedian.
They're buying these companies lock, stock, and barrel so that they can have access to that content and then change it over time. I mean, and by change, I mean they can add to it.
That sort of influence worries a group of lawmakers. They fear the company will push Chinese propaganda and are calling for more oversight of its purchases. But Wanda's leaders say, no, they're just after profit. Carl Gerth is a professor of history at UC San Diego. He says the purchases allow Wanda to learn from Hollywood.
So that you can either do more of that abroad or you can apply what you've learned to the domestic market in China.
Over the last decade, China's invested more than $7 billion into U.S. entertainment, according to the research group Rhodium. Far more than the U.S. has sunk into China's entertainment business, says Yang Zhu, a professor at the City University of New York.
There are, you know, I think there are certain regulations in China that is very protective. It's the growth of its domestic sectors.
Meanwhile, Wanda has been eyeing a next purchase, one of Hollywood's big movie studios. I'm Rima Kreis for Marketplace.
It's not a stretch to say that encryption and security are the hot things online right now, protecting yourself and your information. That's why starting just after New Year's, Google, maker of Chrome, the most popular web browser out there, is going to force you, or really try hard to make you, be safe. Gigi Duban reports.
Let's say you go to a news site and it's unencrypted. That means anyone looking in on what you're doing online can see all the information being passed back and forth, including your password.
It would be really, really easy for any attacker to grab that password, try it in a bank site, and get in.
Emily Schechter is product manager with the Google Chrome security team. She says now Chrome users visiting an unsecure site see an icon. It's the letter I in a circle. They can click on that for more info. But in January, if a site doesn't use HTTPS encryption,
they'll just say not secure in text in the address bar next to the icon.
Schechter says the January launch is to give sites time to switch over to secure encryption. Elad Uran, executive chairman of CoolSpan, which makes programs for people to communicate securely on cell phones, says he likes Google's tactic.
Using peer pressure, you know, and shame to call out websites that are not taking the extra step.
That extra step of turning on HTTPS is easier and cheaper than it used to be. But Phil Libin of the tech venture capitalist firm General Catalyst says it could be a big deal for some companies, like media sites.
Just because most media sites have gotten so complicated with all of their third-party ad networks.
Because not only will those sites have to be secure, but so will all of their ads. So anything that makes the internet safer is good for Google. I'm Gigi Duban for Marketplace.
There's a movie opening today in what Hollywood likes to call wide release. Thousands of screens across the country. Quite a bump up from its debut in just 36 theaters a couple of weeks ago. But it already has that Oscar buzz going. It's called Moonlight. It's set in Miami. It's a quiet film made by a black filmmaker and an all-black cast. It's about drugs and race and sexuality and a whole bunch of other things. And it is pretty much the antithesis of the recent string of big-budget blockbusters. Barry Jenkins wrote and directed it. Barry, welcome to the program.
It's good to be here, man. Thanks for having me.
This is not a film that one would think studios would get behind, right? It's a complicated, difficult, emotional story. It's a black cast. It's a director who's not known. Tell me how this film got made.
Yeah, you know, it's one of those things. I mean, everything you say is true. it doesn't fit the metrics of what's a studio film or what's a commercial film or a bankable film. And yet, I made a film in 2008 called Medicine for Melancholy.
Yep. With Wyatt Cenac, right?
Wyatt Cenac, right. That we made for about a $15,000 production budget. Grossed like $120,000 at the box office.
Which is a plus, right? I mean, you're in the black.
We're on the marketplace, so I got to state my financials. And I'd met Plan B through that process.
Right, the production house.
Exactly, Brad Pitt's company. And so it had been like 5 years since I'd done anything, and I'd written the script, and I was at the Telluride Film Festival in 2013, and I introduced the world premiere of 12 Years a Slave, which is also produced by Plan B. And so myself and my producer, Adela Romansky, who I went to film school with, we ran to Plan B there. You know, and they were like, hey, what are you doing? I was like, well, I actually just adapted this play by Terrell McCraney.
Right.
And that was kind of how the process began.
You and Terrell McCraney, since you brought him up, you grew up, this film is set in Miami, in Liberty City, which is where you grew up, which is where Terrell McCraney grew up, although you didn't know each other together growing up.
Yeah, we lived blocks from one another, and both our moms went through this addiction to crack cocaine, so vividly depicted by Naomi Harris in the film.
Yeah.
And yet we never knew one another, yeah. In 2003, he wrote the first draft of In Moonlight, Black Boys Look Blue, and I think it was very personal and semi-autobiographical. And it was beautiful because when it came to me, it had enough space that I could put my sort of biography, you know, into this character of Chiron, the main character in the film. And once we decided to structure it in these three chapters, then I really found all these in-between places to sort of place what I call all these memories of what it was like to grow up in this place into the film.
This film says a lot of things about masculinity in this society and mass incarceration. It also talks a lot about demographics and economics and class and society and work.
See, this is why I'm on the
marketplace. That's why you're on this program. But it does, right?
No, it does. And we don't talk about that a lot. You know, I love that. You know, Naomi Harris is the only actor who appears in all three stories.
Yep, she plays the mom.
She plays the mom. And I love that when you first meet her, she's this working single woman. You know, she shows up in a nurse's uniform. She's got her badge and everything. And you see over the course of the film, to me, that character is a microcosm of the neighborhood I grew up in that went from this place where there was industry, there were these jobs, and crack cocaine hit, and then you just saw people who were these very almost pillars of the community just hit rock bottom, you know? And with that, you have these kids who now they aren't provided for, you know, they can't eat as much as they did, you know, they're not, nobody's telling them to go to school. All these things ripple throughout. The movie's not about all those things, I must say, people in the marketplace.
As he speaks to the
microphone. All those things are tucked away. But if you look,
but
they're there, exactly. If you do an active read of the film, they're there, yeah.
It's interesting to me that you can talk almost in the third person about this movie. You can talk about it being aggressive and visually this and visually it's you've like detached somehow. Is that what happened? You put it in the can and then you got to go on and...
No, it's not that. I think as a filmmaker, you know, to do what I do, especially in this film, because some of this stuff was really personal. I mean, in the days that I worked with Naomi Harris, essentially playing this composite of my mom and Terrell's mom, was really intense. And the only way you get through that is to know I am a craftsperson. I am a filmmaker. I am creating this thing. The thing isn't me. I'm going to put a lot of myself into it, but it's a movie. You know, and it's the only way I can get through it. The only way I can get through it. And I've been pretty consistent with that. You know, everything that's happened in the last 8 weeks has been amazing. And I remember thinking that this could happen. And so I took like a week to myself before anybody saw the film at Telluride. And I wrote down what I thought the film was, how good I thought it was, what I was proud of, what I wasn't so proud of. And I kind of stick to those things. And so it makes it a bit easier to talk about the film as the film.
There is a conversation that's going to be had when Oscar time rolls around. And you're going to be in that conversation. This film is going to be in that conversation. And juxtaposing there somewhere is going to be this idea that we've seen for a couple of years now of Oscar so white. What are your thoughts on that?
My thoughts on that are twofold. One, it takes a long time to make a film. So this film began about 3.5 years ago. I'm sure some of these other films, Fences, Birth of a Nation, Queen of Cotway, 13th. I mean, there's just so many of these films this year that all probably began 4, 5, 6 years ago.
And all of which are themed along actors and characters of color.
Of color, exactly. And take it a step further, you know, predominantly filmmakers of color, like the directors, the writers, the producers. So I think the response has already begun, and you're seeing it in the work. And to frame these pieces, you know, as a sort of reflection of the conversation that's been had for the last 18 months is a bit false, you know, because I think it takes a bit of the will away from the creators and from the financiers and things like that who have begun to do the work to address this lack of diversity.
As you go into wide release, are you daunted at all? Or are you a little
apprehensive? Not daunted. I mean, I think I'm trying to place myself into anyone's shoes and have a bit of distance from it. I'm very curious, man. I'm curious to see because I know what's in the film. And, you know, a buddy of mine, he went and saw the film in San Francisco and somebody sat behind him. And this guy was making all these like, oh, man, oh, not this, during some of the scenes in the film.
Yeah.
And he was like, but the guy stayed through the whole movie and was dead quiet when the film ended. And he was like, even if you didn't change that guy's mind, he saw something that he hadn't seen before, you know? And again, that's a conversation that he's going to go and have with someone else. So I'm very curious to see what the people between the coast are going to think of the film.
It's a film called Moonlight. Cannot recommend it highly enough. Barry Jenkins, thanks.
Thank you, Brad. Marketplace. Kyrie's now.
We had a good chat, Barry and I did. I know I say this all the time, but this time I actually really do seriously mean it. The long version of this interview was good. You can find it at marketplace.org. Other projects Barry Jenkins has been working on and why he thinks movies ought to be more like books. Give it a listen. Final note on the way out today, in which Broadway basically gives up in the face of this election. I saw this in the New York Times today. About half of the theaters on Broadway are going dark Tuesday night because playing to empty houses is no fun. Kinky Boots, The Color Purple, and Wicked are taking the night off, a bunch of others as well. Hamilton, which is, of course, sold out, is going to go ahead. One does wonder, though, what the former Treasury Secretary would think of this year, huh? All right, Friday afternoon, we are out of here. The Dow off 42 points, 0.2%. The NASDAQ down 12 points, 0.25%. The S&P 500 extended its minor, as John Carney said, losing streak, down 3 points, 0.1%. Our theme music was composed by BJ Lederman. Marketplace is produced by Nancy Fargali. Saturn Yeves is the executive producer of this program. Deborah Clark is the vice president. I'm Kai Rizal. Have a good weekend, everybody. We'll see you Monday, all right? This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.